Chapter 21. Spire Albion, Fleet Shipyards. Bridget held Raoul in her cradled arms as they walked up the spiral ramp leading from Habel Morning to the shipyards on the spire's rooftop, and tried to keep her breathing steady.
"Honestly," Raoul said, "what are you so concerned with, little mouse?"
"I've never," Bridget said, "I've never really been outside."
"There are many things you have never done," Raoul responded. "To be frightened of them is of no use to you."
Bridget glanced over her shoulder, where Benedict was walking with Master Ferris, never more than a couple of strides away from the old man. He'd shouldered his own pack, and an enormous duffel, apparently meant for Master Ferris and his apprentice, and carried them absently, his eyes sweeping everywhere, even here in Habel Morning.
"I'm not frightened," Bridget replied. "I'm simply considering the possibilities."
"Such as falling off the spire?"
Raoul asked. Bridget swallowed.
"Yes."
"Or some enormous monster flying in from the mist and devouring you?"
"I'm certain the tower's defences are perfectly adequate to repel mist moors."
"Or being driven mad by the light of the sun?"
Bridget's fingers immediately went to her neck, where her goggles with their protective lenses hung.
"Raoul, my friend, you are at times a perfect little monster."
Raoul gave his tail a disdainful flick.
"I am a perfect everything."
"You speak with the cats, Miss Targwyn?"
asked the man walking beside her. Captain Grimm, his arm still in its grimy sling, looked like a man who should be collapsing from exhaustion, but his voice was steady, polite, his eyes alert.
"Imperfectly," Bridget said, "though honestly I think most of them understand every word we say, except when they don't, of course."
He glanced at Raoul, smiling.
"An unkind thing to say of a hero."
Raoul flicked his tail again, his expression unrepentantly smug. Bridget smiled at that and rubbed her nose against Raoul's furry head.
"He is a hero. And a tyrant."
The cat looked up at her and yawned. Grimm let out a short bark of laughter.
"Aye, aye."
"The cat who lived on Perilous was much the same. He didn't take orders well, and we were lucky to have him."
"This one,"
Raoul said, looking at Grimm.
"This one seems smarter than most humans, little mouse. I have decided that he may stay."
"Given that it is his ship that will carry us," Bridget said, her tone dry, "that seems very practical."
Grimm seemed to infer Raoul's portion of the exchange and inclined his head slightly to the cat.
"At your service, sir." "Ah, the guard station. Good."
Their small group had reached the top of the ramp leading up to the shipyards. A large metal grate had been lowered over the doorway out, and at least 20 marines stood on guard at it. Gwendolyn Lancaster had evidently taken her duty seriously. She was already there, speaking quietly with a senior sergeant, showing him the letter of authorization from the Spyrarch. The marine did not look pleased with her. Gwen frowned, put one fist on her hip, and said something to the man with a rather tart expression on her face. The marine's weather-beaten face grew redder, but he growled and jerked a hand in a quick motion. One of his men went to the grate and began pulling on a rope that lifted it, opening the way to the shipyards. Light, nearly as bright as the flash of a discharged gauntlet, poured down the ramp from the outside world. With it came a breath of wind and air that was much colder than that of the Habel in which Bridget had grown up. There was a strange scent to it, wood, and burnt wood, and metal, and something else, something sharp and fresh. Bridget's heart started pounding. Captain Grimm said something to her, but she wasn't sure what. They walked up the ramp and into the sharp-scented air and the dazzling light. It was bright, painfully bright, like suddenly understanding a truth she would prefer to be anything else. She had to blink her eyes closed as the cold air hit her in the face, an utter shock of sensation. She had never felt anything like it. Then she remembered in a panic how dangerous it was to let the light touch her unprotected eyes, and she fumbled blindly at the goggles around her neck. It was difficult, with only one hand to use, but she finally managed to lift them to her face and hold them there with her quivering fingers. The dark lenses reduced the glare of the light, and she could suddenly see. For a moment, she wished she couldn't. There were structures and airships and people everywhere in the shipyard, but that was of distant secondary importance. She looked up and felt as though she might simply fall over onto the ground out of sheer disorientation. There was no ceiling. There was no ceiling. She looked up, and up, and up, and up, and there was simply nothing overhead. Nothing but a light, fine veil of mist that rose into infinite distance above her. She felt an irrational conviction that she was balanced on a precipice, and that a single misstep might betray her and send her body flying up into the void. She jerked her eyes back down to the floor. She fought away a sudden, overwhelming impulse to throw herself prone and hang on to the solid spirestone floor for dear life.
"Easy," she heard Captain Grimm saying. "For some, the first time is a shock, Miss Targwin."
"I'm sorry," she managed to say. "I don't mean to make a scene. Normally I am quite composed."
"You're doing better than I did," Grimm said. "I lost my breakfast and couldn't make myself look up again for days."
"What did you do?"
"I kept trying until I looked up," he said. "It got better. Don't be hard on yourself, miss. It will pass."
"I think it's very interesting,"
Raoul said in a calm, pleased tone. Bridget choked off something that might have come out a laugh or a sob. She wasn't sure which. She still felt dizzy, sickened, but clearly this problem wasn't going to solve itself. The sky wasn't going anywhere. So she took a deep breath and forced herself to lift her eyes again. She could see a burning orb outlined in the mist. The sun. She had never seen it like this, without it being filtered and diffused through the translucent sections of spirestone around the Habel. It burned, like no candle or crystal she had ever seen.
"That's..." she breathed. "That's lovely."
Grimm glanced up and then smiled.
"A bit of a dingy view," he said. "When time serves, you should see what the sky really looks like."
"You mean..."
Bridget asked, pointing. "Up there?" She turned to find Captain Grimm staring up and smiling serenely.
"Up there. Up in the deep blue sky. If you think the sun is beautiful, wait until you see it without all the mist. And the moon. And the stars. There is no beauty like that of the stars on a clear night, Miss Targwin."
"But," she said, "isn't it dangerous to see such things? I thought men who did went mad."
"Oh, you'll need goggles during the day, it's true," Grimm replied.
"Airships sail in etheric currents, and they interact oddly with sunlight. If one doesn't protect one's eyes from them, it can do strange things to one's mind."
Bridget glanced ahead of them at Master Ferris. Is that why Lord Albion's man is so odd?"
"He's an etherealist, Miss Targwin," Grimm replied. "For most of us, etheric currents flow around us like a stream of water flowing around stones. But for some folk, etheric energy doesn't go around. It courses right through them. They draw it to them."
He shook his head.
"Goggles are sufficient for the likes of you and me, miss. But there's no protection for a man like Master Ferris."
"He's mad?"
Bridget asked in a quiet voice.
"So is his apprentice, though less so," Grimm said. "Master Ferris is the fourth etherealist I've met in my lifetime. They've all been mad. The only question is whether or not it shows.
Oh,
Bridget said.
I do not mean to pester you with more questions, Captain, if you have duties to see to.
He shook his head. By all means, miss, ask. I am to provide you with my support, after all. Presumably sharing what modest knowledge I have falls into the purview of that duty. Ask your questions.
Thank you. The etherealists, can they really do what the stories say?
Asked Bridget. It depends on which stories you've heard, I suppose, Grimm said.
The usual, I think,
Bridget said.
Burnham's tales. The stories of Finch and Broom.
Grimm smiled a bit and spread his hands.
Well, they are perhaps a touch overblown.
But etherealists really can do such things,
Bridget asked.
Call lightning with a word of power. Make a mystic gesture and fly.
Try not to think of it that way, Grimm said. Etherealists are, in many ways, simply etheric engineers.
Etheric engineers cannot call lightning, sir, or fly.
No? Grimm asked. But they can design etheric weaponry, such as gauntlets, long guns, and cannon, can they not? Can they not design an airship and send it aloft into the sky?
True,
Bridget said.
But those are... they're weapons and ships. Of course they do that. They design and build devices to a function. It's what they do.
My point is that an etherealist does the same sorts of things, miss. It's just that he skips the troublesome part in the middle.
Bridget found herself smiling.
Oh,
she said.
Is that all he does?
Grimm winked at her.
Are they dangerous?
She asked. He was silent for a moment before he said thoughtfully,
Anyone can be dangerous, Mr. Ogwin, etherealist or not.
He smiled at her, but then his face sobered.
But between the two of us, I think they are capable of more than we know. For myself, I think it wise to keep a very open mind.
They had walked down the length of the shipyard as they spoke, and had come to a large boarding ramp that led up to an airship.
Captain Grimm, Bridget asked, is this your vessel?
Aye, Grimm replied, unmistakable pride in his voice. This is Predator, Miss Targwin. I take it you have not been aboard an airship before.
Bridget shook her head, staring up.
I've never even seen one.
Predator was, Bridget thought, rather impressive. The main body of the ship seemed to be a large and oddly contoured half-tube suspended between three rounded towers that rose up at either end of the ship and in her very middle. Folded along her flanks were a number of bundled rods of some kind that looked like they could be folded out, and old-style canvas cloth hung from them. Sails, she realized, made to be extended horizontally along the ship's flanks. Other masts had been folded against her belly, which was held clear of the stone of the shipyard by heavy struts that supported the vessel's weight. And she saw two more masts on the ship's main deck rose up above the ship, their yardarms spread, with more sails reefed against them. Running up the length of both masts were large metal rings that encircled twisted lengths of ether silk sail, the ship's ether web. Most airships she had read about had steam engines in place as their secondary propulsion system. The only ships that favoured sails were those operated by the fleets of very poor spires, or by scoundrels such as pirates, smugglers and the like, who were willing to dare the dangers of the mists rather than sail in open skies. Positioned all around the vessel, at the bases of the masts, she could see large reels lined with the net-like woven ether silk webs that harnessed the etheric currents that would drive airships faster than any other transport in the world. She understood the principle simply enough. The more webbing one let out of the reel, the more etheric energy it could catch, and the faster it would drive the ship forward. Of course, the web had to be charged with electricity in order for it to function,
so airships were limited in the amount of web they could charge by the strength of their power cores. And there were the weapons. The gun emplacements protruded bulbously from the ship's deck, the copper-barreled cannon snouts nosing out from a costly rotating ball assembly that would allow the gun crews to swing the cannon forward and aft as well as up and down. She had no way to judge how large the weapons were in comparison to others of the breed, but they certainly looked formidable. One of the gun emplacements, Bridget noted, was simply missing. There were a number of freshly cut boards around it, suggesting that it had been damaged in some fashion, necessitating the removal of more wood in order to provide a stable platform to replace the missing assembly. And the entire ship, she realized, was made of wood. So much wood that it beggared her imagination. She remembered how proud her father had been when they had been able to afford the polished wooden service counter at the Vattery, and how careful he was to clean and maintain it. It had cost a week's profit for enough wood to build a counter 10 feet long and 3 feet wide. And Predator, Bridget realized, was a dozen times that length, and as high as a two-story house. All of it wood. There were men on the ship, moving all over it, men carrying crates and bags up the boarding ramp, men on lines hanging down the side of the ship, applying oil to her hull, men atop the towers, men climbing the masts and working with the reefed sails, men scrubbing down the deck, men inspecting the weapon emplacements, men coiling costly ether silk webbing more neatly onto its reel. There was a small army aboard this vessel, Bridget realized, each of them performing some kind of specific task. And it was a good thing there were so many of them. They might not have survived the confrontation in the tunnel without the aeronauts, whatever Gwendolyn seemed to think.
"If you will excuse me, Miss Targwyn," Captain Grimm said, "there are many things to which I must attend before we can leave."
Bridget inclined her head. "Of course, sir." He nodded and bowed slightly at the waist.
"Someone will be down momentarily to show your party where to go."
He ascended the ramp, weaving between several men carrying various burdens without missing a step. Raoul was staring up at the ship, his eyes intent, tracking motion, his ears pulled to quivering attention, straight forward.
"Little Mouse," he said, "that looks interesting."
"Not too interesting, I trust," Bridget said. "Airships are quite dangerous, you know."
"Dangerous," Raoul said, contempt dripping from the word. "For humans, perhaps."
"Don't be foolish," she said. "There could be any number of hazards in there. Machinery, electrical wiring, weaponry. If you go exploring, you might find something that could hurt you."
"If one doesn't, one is not truly exploring," Raoul replied. "But since you worry so badly, and since I know you will not stop speaking of it, regardless of how foolish you sound, I will remain near you, to make sure that you do not run afoul of hazards aboard the ship, of course."
"Thank you," Bridget said.
"But those tall ship trees standing up on top?"
"We call them masts," Bridget said. She had to use the human word for them. The tongue of the cat had the occasional shortcoming.
"Ship trees,"
Raoul said in an insistent tone.
"Those interest me. I will climb them."
"All the way up there?" Bridget asked. She felt slightly dizzy just thinking of the view from the mast tops. "It seems unnecessary."
Raoul turned his head and gave her a level look. Then he said,
"I sometimes forget that you are just a human."
He flicked his ears dismissively and looked back up at the masts.
"A cat would understand."
"Just so long as the cat doesn't fall," she said.
Raoul made a growling sound, an expression of displeasure that needed no special skill to understand. Bridget smiled. She couldn't help it. The little monster was so full of himself that she couldn't help but tease him from time to time.
She hugged Raoul gently and rubbed her nose against the fur on his head.
Raoul growled again, but with much less sincerity. Suddenly there was a presence beside her, and Bridget looked up to see that the etherealist's apprentice was standing next to her. The girl with the oddly coloured eyes stared up at the ship, but not, Bridget noted, at the features to which her own eyes had been drawn. Instead, the girl seemed to stare intently at the featureless planks of Predator's flanks, and left Bridget with the slightly unsettling impression that the girl's mismatched eyes were peering straight through the wood.
"Oh, my!"
the girl said, ducking her head enough to make it clear that she was speaking to the jar of expended lumen crystals she still held cradled in one arm.
"Have you ever seen one like that?"
"Beg pardon, miss?"
Bridget said politely.
"Oh, they're talking to me again,"
the girl told the jar.
"Why must people always talk to me when I leave the house?"
Bridget blinked several times at her response. What did one do in such a situation? It seemed unthinkable that they should stand together looking at such an impressive creation and not carry on some sort of polite conversation.
I'm afraid I don't know your name, miss. We are to be working together, it seems. My name is Bridget Tarquin, and this is Raoul."
The girl smiled and said to the jar,
"This is Bridget Tarquin, and Raoul, and we're to be working together."
Bridget frowned. The girl's response had not been rude, precisely. It had simply been so disconnected from the situation that etiquette utterly failed to apply.
"May I know your name, please?"
The girl sighed.
"She wants to know my name, but I'm simply awful at introducing myself. Perhaps I should tattoo Folly on my head, and then people can just read it."
"Folly," Bridget said. "It's a pleasure to meet you, Folly."
"She seems very sweet,"
Folly told the jar.
"I'm sure she means well."
Raoul said,
"This girl has too many things in her head, I think."
Folly replied,
"Oh, the cat is right. All the things I've forgotten, plus all the things I haven't. I keep forgetting over which ones I need to throw a dust tarp."
Bridget blinked again. Before she left the Vattery, she could have counted on one hand the number of people she'd met who actually understood cat. She glanced down to find Raoul staring into infinite distance, exhibiting no reaction. Bridget knew the cat well enough to know that he had not been surprised. Gwendolen and Benedict caught up to them, finally, with Benedict staying close to a bemused Master Ferris's side.
"Simply saying," Benedict said, "that perhaps you could have gained the guard's cooperation without resorting to threatening to arrest him for impeding an inquisition."
Gwendolen frowned. "Ought I have threatened to charge him with treason, do you think? That one bears the death penalty."
Benedict gave his cousin a rather hunted look.
"Gwen, you... I can't possibly..." He shook his head, mouth open for a second. A very small smile touched Gwen's mouth and her eyes sparkled.
Benedict sighed and shut his mouth again. "Touché. I'll stop telling you how to do your job now, cuz."
"Thank you,"
Gwen said.
Bridget smiled slightly at the exchange, and even Raoul seemed amused.
Not a minute later, a very tall young man, dark-haired and square-jawed, descended briskly from the ship and approached them, dressed in an aeronaut's leathers, his goggles hanging around his neck. He came to a stop before them, gave them a bow, and said,
"Ladies and gentlemen, I am Byron Creedy, Predator's executive officer. Master Ferris, Captain Grimm has asked me to bring you and your party aboard at your earliest convenience."
The old etherealist blinked and looked up from whatever private thoughts had preoccupied him. He looked the young man up and down, nodded, and said,
"Convenient would have been yesterday. Now will suffice."
Creedy arched a brow at this answer, but he bowed his head and said,
"Then if you would all please follow me. Welcome aboard, Predator."